if irons hadn't been invented, do dryers actually save time? A new exhibition at the National Museum of Science and Technology raises some questions about the relationship between appliances and housework. It's called Love, Leisure, and Laundry, Why Housework Won't Go Away. Terry Rudell curated the exhibit. He's in our Ottawa studio. Joy Parr is a professor of history at Simon Fraser University, and she's on the line from New Westminster, B.C. Good morning to the two of you.
Good morning.
Terry, with all of our appliances, why does it still take so long to clean the house?
Well, I think, Sheila, the standard answer to that is that with all of our appliances, we're now doing more, and our standards have gone up. And I guess what people are saying today is we have to consider dropping the mop and blessing the mess.
You came up with the title, it sounds like, did you?
Actually, I didn't. No, some of my colleagues that are more creative than I am did.
It's great. Joy, is part of the problem that the appliances are just doing such a good job that we're becoming cleaner and cleaner all the time?
No, I think that's not what's going on at all. I think what's happening is that lots more jobs are coming back into the home, that we're bringing work back into the home from the market. But I don't think it's a question that women have become deluded into having higher and higher standards. Remember that in our mother's days, men's work shirts went out to be done at the laundry. Their uniforms were washed where they worked. We had linen done in commercial establishments. Most households had a little bit of domestic help of some sort. We're involved in much more complex home cooking and catering than we used to be. In the 1950s, it looked as if there was more and more work being done in the home because women were getting involved in more production of clothing and curtains. I think that we just do a lot more in the home than we used to because these machines make us think that it's necessary for us to be self-sufficient, kind of the Martha Stewart syndrome.
Terry, when did the first home appliances arrive in the home?
The first home appliances arrived, well, I guess it depends on what you call a home appliance, but if we're talking about gas and electrical appliances, Sheila, they started to arrive at the turn of the century, and I guess 1920s became a watershed where you had the introduction of all sorts of mainly electrical appliances like irons, washing machines, fridges, etc.
I'm talking beyond washboard, that's for sure. And have they changed much since the 20s, Terry?
Well, in my opinion, they haven't. I think that the 1920s saw the introduction of a whole range of technologies that we kind of take for granted today, like nichrome, starting mechanisms for fridges and refrigerants and those kinds of technologies that, in effect, haven't really changed a lot today, although people keep, advertisers keep telling us that we're going to get something new and innovative, whereas I don't think since the 20s and 30s we've seen much that's really new and innovative.
Joy, what did the first appliances mean to the people who owned them?
Oh, to the people who owned them.
The people who used them.
Right. I think the first thing to look at for those first appliances is why they were the first ones. That is, the first appliances were ones that were built to sell electricity at non-peak hours in the power utilities day. So a lot of this equipment wasn't designed to be well used in the home. It was designed to sell electricity and equipment into the home. This exhibit begins with a wonderful panel of a breakfast table, which I think is splendidly appropriate. There's a 1920s toaster that actually has a base on it of bridal rose china. Remember those platters you see in antique stores? But the reason that those are some of the first pieces of equipment that go into the home isn't that it's a lot more wonderful to toast your toast on a bridal rose toaster, but that you plug in the toaster before the industrial load in the day began. So for me, the first question is, why is this what is the first that's offered? Early washing machines actually don't save labor. The Swedes did careful studies on these in the 20s, and a lot of those early ones took more labor to use than if you'd used a washboard. it's not until the good ringers in the 20s and the 30s that we're actually seeing a saving from that technology.
Sheila, I find that an interesting question, too, because in the little bit of work I've done on this subject, I think that some of the really early appliances, for example, like the sewing machine and the fan, which were both late 19th century, came almost at the same time as electricity, and really before a lot of electrical utilities were set up and running, like Ontario Hydro, for example, that really started in the early 20th century and then started to promote a lot of appliances after that.
Well, how did people perceive the automatic washing machine when it first came out, Joy?
They were immensely suspicious of it. It seemed like a sorcerer's apprentice to bring into your basement, partly literally because in the first years it was very difficult to get them to stay stable, even on a good cement floor, but also because they used a lot of water, a lot of hot water. There was you could see the water flowing out of them and into them, and it made people very worried about their wells and their septic tanks. They seemed like a prodigal appliance, and many women, Canadian women, were particularly reluctant to take them into their homes. Also, technically, though they were for sale, they were in the catalogs from Eaton's, they were in display in store windows. The mechanical systems of most Canadian homes through until the mid or late 1950s wouldn't sustain them because they needed a constant pressure of water and a large supply of water. In fact, the use of automatics in Canada declines a bit in the late 19th century, in the late 1950s, because as more women move into the suburbs, they move away from municipal water systems where they would have been able to safely use an automatic.
Now, what about the dryer? Does it actually save work?
I don't think there's any doubt that it does, but that's one that used a lot of electricity and that was sold by utilities across the country during the Diefenbaker recession as a way to try to build domestic load to compensate for declines in commercial and industrial load.
But here's the other thing, and in a couple of hours I'm talking to a writer from New Brunswick named Beth Pounding, and she writes about the slap and crackle of dish towels out on the line. That kind of went when the dryer came in, right? And the nice neighborly chat over your sheets.
And the line is still the most efficient way, the clothesline is still the most efficient way to dry your clothes.
The thing that women tell me about that period, with a slight sort of self-chuckle, I think, is that they do remember liking the smell, the look of the line, the sort of pride of having the laundry there, and they enjoyed the visiting time, and that once they had a dryer in their basement, they realized that they didn't have that period when they were observing their neighbors and talking with their neighbors. That's obviously a kind of mixed blessing, but it's part of a story about the growing sort of isolation in our domestic settings.
And hasn't the clothesline fresh smell become part of some other marketing drive?
Indeed, that very critique of the dryer then got incorporated into a new commercial product by the early 1960s.
But I think, Sheila, if we get back to washing for a moment, I'm not sure if any of us would like to go back to 1840, where it took a week to wash clothes. And I guess one of the things about the early electrical appliances that they shorted, they shocked, they overheated, they didn't start, and all of those kinds of problems. And I agree with Joy that we've been kind of convinced that we're doing less, whereas in effect we're doing more. But some of the innovations, like the 1930s capacitor start mechanism that helped to provide extra torque to overcome starting inertia in the washing machines at that particular time, did have a major impact on washing, so that today I think we wash every day, and as a matter of fact, Canadians probably wash their clothes and their cars and themselves more than anybody else, so that we use more water than anybody else in the world. So, you know, we have got into some really bad habits.
I will never look at my washing machine again without thinking about torque, Terry. Thank you. But let me talk to you about the iron. Who invented this? What scientist came up with the idea?
Well, I think the iron has been around for a long time. It's obviously been around for centuries. But one of the people that was really important in the evolution of the iron, if you like, was a woman by the name of Mary Florence Potts, who patented a double pointed flat iron and with detachable wooden handles, so that you wouldn't get burnt all the time when you were trying to iron something.
Now, these machines actually create work, though, don't they?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think they create work, and people, advertisers have constantly said, for example, that the rotary iron that came out in the 20s and 30s, it promised to reduce backaches as well as ironing time on flat work, but then they threw into that you were going to do your sheets, your pillowcases, and with practice you could even do your ruffles and your pleats too. So yes, I think that we indeed have constantly created work in that respect, and I think Joy is right also in saying that we brought more work back into the home. But irons, they're a really interesting story because I don't think they've ever really been perfected, and I'm not even sure if they are now, because when the early electrical irons came out, they really shorted and shocked everybody, and then when thermostats and plastics came out in the 50s and 60s, supposedly to make irons more reliable, the plastic often warped and caused leaks and leaking problems, and I think probably a lot of us have remember the early steam irons in the 60s and 70s that constantly leaked.
Joy, oven doors are at waist level. You have to bend down and heave heavy objects into them, heavy birds, heavy roasts. They're very inconvenient. Why were they designed this way?
Search me. Canadian women after the Second World War were very firm that they wanted the old ones back. The form of the first generation of gas and electric stoves had an oven that was up at waist level, sort of right beside the burners on the stove. If you look at them in antique stores, you can see them today. And there was a campaign by the Canadian Consumers Association to try to convince Canadian manufacturers that they ought to return to that earlier form, so that you wouldn't have to bend down with a heavy weight. They actually convinced the Findlay Stoveworks there in Carlton Place to make a prototype, but by that point the Canadian appliance manufacturing industry was sufficiently dominated by American car companies that this white box that was easier to tool couldn't be beaten out of the marketplace. I think that's why in the late 1950s, as there continues to be buyer resistance to the lower ovens, the wall oven comes in. But women at that time are really outraged and eager to see if they could make a change. They don't make a change in the actual model for sale. The design process for most electrical appliances, really peculiar in tools in general, does not consult the tool users. Women are thought of as consumers, people who use up electrical equipment, rather than people who, as users, ought to have some authority in its design.
If I could add to that, Sheila, one of the things that we have gleaned in our work with manufacturers, and we've done quite a bit of work with them, with the engineers maintain now that today nothing comes on the market before tremendous consultation with focus groups. Now, I'm not quite sure what impact that has on the final product, but apparently that's an essential part of the production today.
That focus group consultation is usually trying to think about what will be for what will sell well rather than what is used well. And I think it doesn't deal with the problem of having a group of people who have, as users, have some sort of command over engineering expertise to be able to formulate alternatives.
Terry, if you had to pick one appliance in your home that you couldn't do without, what would it be?
Oh, I don't know if there's anything that I really couldn't do without. Probably the stove.
Joy?
Well, automatic washer, even after all I've said.
I can't believe it. What about the microwave?
Oh, I don't own one.
I use it all the time, Sheila, but I could certainly do without it.
Here, I think, is the big time-saving device. The microwave, right? No, and the dishwasher. Well, I'm taking them with me. That's for sure.
Where are you going? You're not traveling light.
That's true, and I'll need to camp where there's some place to plug in. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Joy Parr in Vancouver and Terry Riddell in Ottawa.